Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For the better part of the last 4 years, the peace process to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been moribund. By all accounts, the relationship between former President Barack Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was the worst between these two leaders in the country's history. Now, with a new president and administration, what are the options and possible outcomes in the Middle East for the Trump administration, as well as the peoples and leaderships of the players in the region? My guest today is Dr. Gershon Baskin, who founded the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, a joint public policy think tank. He's long been an advisor to Israeli, Palestinian, and international leaders involved in the peace process, and he was the initiator and negotiator of a secret back channel between Israel and Hamas for the release of one Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, which resulted in the release of over 1,000 prisoners, mainly Palestinians and Arab Israelis. His book, The Negotiator, Freeing Gilad Shalit from Hamas, was published in 2013. He's the author of a forthcoming book, In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine, which will be out this year. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, and he's also currently the country manager for Palestine and Egypt in Gigawatt Global, which is developing affordable solar projects with the goal of providing clean energy for 50 million people by 2020. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. Gershon Baskin, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're going to be speaking to the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations on how the region of Israel, the West Bank, the Palestinians are going to react to a Trump presidency. Certainly in the campaign, there was a lot of really interesting rhetoric coming from the Trump campaign, one about moving the embassy to Jerusalem. He seems to have backtracked on that. So what is the assessment from people in Israel and from the Palestinian Authority and from the various players on the ground?
I think that no one really knows what to expect, which is probably no different than on almost every issue that was in the campaign. President Trump has retracted on almost every issue that he spoke about from day to day. In fact, it's difficult to find any consistency of policy, any coherence in policy, certainly with regard to the Middle East. There are these broad general statements that merge or converge with local interests, both of Israel and the Sunni moderate Arab world, of which the Palestinians are generally part of. So there's the fight against ISIS, and there's the fight against the axis of evil today, which is Iran, Hezbollah, Syria, etc. But Trump's engagements with Russia are curious, to say the least, in terms of trying to understand what policy might look like vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine and other parts of the region. He has met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they apparently have a fantastic relationship. We know that Prime Minister Netanyahu has essentially been the equivalent of a member of the Republican Party for a long time, and Israel's ambassador in Washington, Ron Dermer, has been someone who's worked hand in hand with the Republicans in the past, even during the Obama period. But Trump has also engaged President Abbas now, the Palestinian president who's on his way, and he's engaged Abdel Fattah Sisi, the president of Egypt, and has great praise for Sisi as being someone dedicated to fighting terrorism. And of course, the new Saudi princes who are young and more progressive and are making changes in that part of the world. It's really difficult to know what he's going to do. I was asked during the transition period by someone from the State Department to write a very short brief on what I thought the general tone of the Trump administration's policy should be on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict question. And the best advice that I could give was, don't do anything, announce to the Israelis and the Palestinians that you're not going to help them resolve the conflict. Get back into the room by yourselves, and when you need our help, we'll be there. I think this is really the best thing that the Americans could do, is wean the Israelis and wean the Palestinians away from this notion that some giant third party is going to come here and resolve the solution, because there will be no imposed solution. We're really going to have to do it by ourselves, and the more we're waiting for someone else to do it, the less responsibility we take ourselves.
Why is it that seemed to be the way forward in negotiations, this inability to speak directly to one another without a third party sort of brokering it?
We can speak to each other. We do it on a day-to-day basis at the technical level in the field with regard to security cooperation. We have to do it with regard to economic realities and dealing with energy, electricity, and water and environment, etc. The Palestinians always feel that they, of course, have the lower hand. They're the underdogs. They have less this power, and the Palestinians have this illusion, this dream that someone's going to come along and force Israel to do things that Israel doesn't want to do. The Palestinians never viewed the United States as an impartial broker. What they used to say is that the United States is perhaps the only effective broker because they're the only ones who can apply pressure to Israel. The problem is that they never do. They never did. And it's not likely that a Trump administration will do that either.
So on a technical level, yes, there is interactions. But when you're talking the top levels of government, there seems to be not that ability.
No, there isn't talking. There haven't been negotiations going on for years since the Kerry process failed in 2013. There haven't been any political negotiations going on. Again, it's against this backdrop that someone is going to come along, the European Union, the Arab League, the United States,
even Russia at this point.
Or Russia perhaps at this point. And I really think it's counterproductive. When I look over the history of Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, the best negotiations that ever took place were the ones that the Israelis and the Palestinians were in the room by themselves, whether it be the secret back channel that took place in Oslo, or the talks that took place in Taba in 2000, January of 2001, or the talks that took place between Prime Minister Olmert and President Abbas, and they met 42 times, and they came the closest to an agreement than we were ever before. What classically happened during the Kerry period was that the Palestinians spoke to Kerry and Martin and his emissary, and the Israelis talked to Kerry and his emissary, and they didn't talk to each other. Martin Indyk, Ambassador Indyk, told me that he once left the room for 40 minutes and had hoped that they would start talking to each other when he was in the room. He came back 40 minutes later and found them both sitting there silent, waiting for him to come.
Wow. So it really is a matter of getting the two sides in the room and the rest of the world leaving them alone until they're needed.
I think that would be the best way. But again, Trump is so unpredictable that he might actually surprise us. He just sent an emissary to the region, a guy named Jason Greenblatt, someone we didn't really know anything about. He was in the campaign. He was involved in campaigning for the Trump campaign in the Jewish community. He's a religious Jew, right-wing supporter of settlements, not a supporter of the Palestinians. And he shows up in Jerusalem as his title is chief negotiator for the White House. He shows up. The meetings were not scheduled in coordination with the Israeli government or the Palestinian Authority. The American embassy in Tel Aviv wasn't involved in scheduling the meetings. It was done directly out at the White House. He, of course, tweeted every meeting that he held when he was there. But what was unusual about Jason Greenblatt's visit was that he didn't just meet with the Prime Minister and President Abbas or the military people. He also met with members of the opposition, but he also met with civil society. He held a meeting in a refugee camp north of Ramallah in the Jelazun refugee camp with young Palestinian professionals in the refugee camp. He met with a group of business people who got permits to leave Gaza to come into Israel and meet with him. Businessmen in Gaza. He met with young entrepreneurs in Ramallah, Palestinians. He also met with young Israelis and other people. That this is very unusual for an American mediator to come and even be curious about what the people have to say.
So what was the reaction from the people in
the
region?
Well, no one knows because he really listened. He took photographs and tweeted every single meeting that he had. So it was out there. It wasn't being covered by the press. The press corps wasn't following around. He didn't give out interviews, and he said that he came to listen. From what I heard from the meetings, people who took part in the meetings, that they spoke. He asked questions, and he listened. And so who knows? Maybe there is something new here. We saw David Friedman, the appointed ambassador, who before the campaign has a history of right-wing religious positions with regard to Israel and Palestine, against a two-state solution, is supporting settlements. He has paid money from his own pocket to support Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. He called J Street, the alternative pro-peace Jewish lobby, he called them capos, collaborators with the Nazis. And in his hearing in the Senate, he retracted every statement that he's ever made in his whole life about Israel and said that he supports the two-state solution and he thought that settlements had to be limited and that the embassy maybe shouldn't be moved from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. All these positions that he's taken over the years when he was in his Senate hearing, he reversed them.
So what are people like yourself who are really devoted to trying to find a peace between these two people? How are you reacting to this, these two views that are just diametrically opposed.
Well, I relate to it at two levels. One is the political policy level, which I'll touch on in a moment. The other way that I look at it is how can we exploit the moment where there might be an open door to make some real changes on the ground. One of the most important needs on the Palestinian side now is to have access to their land, which is controlled by Israel, what's called Area C, which composes 62% of the West Bank, where over the past 20 years, the Palestinians have basically not been allowed to develop this land. And I've been working in the last 4 years and trying to help the Palestinians create a regulatory framework and laws to enable direct foreign investment in renewable energy. Because they're 100% dependent on Israel for their energy needs. And if we can create some kind of independent Palestinian solar energy, as President Abbas once commented, Israel hasn't yet learned to shut off the sun. So they have the sun, they have the land. If they can get access to the land to develop it for solar energy, they can actually create their own sources of energy and at the same time prove to outsiders that they are responsible and have bankable documents and institutions which can bring in other direct foreign investment. There is a moment of goodwill right now on the ground because neither Netanyahu and his people nor Abbas and his people want to piss off the Trump administration. So this moment of goodwill that exists while everyone's trying to figure out what this new administration in Washington means is that they're open doors. I submitted plots of land in Area C in the West Bank that are owned by Palestinians to get the Israeli army approval now to build solar energy fields. I'm supposed to get an answer tomorrow on several of them. This is really new. I mean, if this happens, it'll be really, I think, quite revolutionary. It's not going to end the occupation and it's not going to resolve the conflict, but it's going to make inroads into something that can have a direct impact on Palestinian economic development.
Well, the very fact that there's places in the West Bank, which nominally has been set aside for a Palestinian state at some point in the future, that Israel says, nope, can't develop it.
That's right.
That's a fundamental sovereignty issue.
Not only that, Israel has been over the years ensuring that the few Palestinians who live in that area, 62% of the West Bank, have been moved out. And they've shut down water wells so that herders, farmers can't have access to water. They have bulldozed structures that were built by the European Union to help these small communities. And Israel was clearly, the strategy has been to reduce the number of people living in that area so that they can say that 98% of the Palestinians live in Area A and B, controlled by the Palestinian Authority, and therefore Area C is open for Israel to develop. All the Israeli settlements are in Area C, and the calls within the Israeli government today from the right wing of Netanyahu within his own political party as well have been calling to annex those areas into Israel or to place Israeli law over those areas. And here's another interesting thing. Our Minister of Defense, Avigdor Lieberman, who's a well-known, very, very right-wing politician in Israel, not religious, but very right-wing and very anti-Arab, reported in the Knesset Foreign Affairs Committee that he received a direct message from the White House that Israel shouldn't even think about annexing parts of the West Bank today. So I don't know how to put all these pieces together. It's clear that they're not moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, as Trump promised 100 times during the campaign.
You know, one of the things you mentioned earlier says, you know, he's backtracked on all of his rhetoric from the campaign. Mm-hmm. Certainly on the domestic side, he hasn't backtracked. I mean, I think that was the expectation that he's moving ahead with everything he said in the campaign. On foreign affairs, though, he has backtracked significantly on the things he said
He's cutting foreign aid, but he's not touching the aid package to Israel.
Yeah.
It's curious. I think that some of it has to do with what we don't really understand about his relationship with Russia. The Russians are real players on the ground now. The Russians are also curious in terms of it, trying to figure out what their policies are. They are definitely hand in hand with the Americans and the West in fighting ISIS. On the other hand, Russia is supporting the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which is supported by Hezbollah, which is supported by the Iranians. And the Israelis have made it very clear that there will not be an Iranian presence along the Israeli border in the Golan Heights with Syria. And Israel just the other day bombed a convoy of weapons that were being sent from Iran to Hezbollah. And for the first time, the Syrians responded by using a Russian anti-aircraft missile, which Israel shot down using its Arrow weapon system the first time it was ever shot. There was a conversation between Putin and Netanyahu on this incident because there have been understandings between Israel and the Russians on fly zones and what Israel can do and cannot do. and maybe the shooting of the Russian missile shot by the Syrian Air Force, but the use of it, they couldn't have used it without the Russian permission. Maybe this is also a signal that Russia is changing. So it's really difficult. We're at a moment of I think it's a very dangerous, potentially dangerous moment. I'm not sure that Trump and his people have the skills at all to deal with the kind of strategic dimensions of global insecurity that we're facing in this very small part of the world.
My guest today is Gershon Baskin, chairman of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations, talking about how the region is going to deal with a Trump administration. And this is so far, it's a lot of question marks. But it sounds like it's a very unorthodox approach, which orthodoxy hasn't really worked. So maybe the unorthodox approach might bear some fruit. I mean, the very idea that this negotiator from the White House spent times in a lot of places that official negotiators really don't.
It's hard to imagine, but it is possibly feasible that this guy Jason Greenblatt and Jared Kushner and a few of the other people in the Trump administration will sit down after they listen to everyone and come back to Israel and the Palestinians and say, here's the deal, you have 24 hours to sign it. Who knows? I mean, maybe they relate to this is buying a new hotel and sign at the bottom line and we'll raise the money to pay for it. Anything is possible at this point. I don't believe that an imposed solution is really possible. And the issues are complex to the extent that you really need professionals figuring out how to do it. We made every mistake possible until now. We have to learn from those mistakes. Part of those mistakes involved in building mechanisms for joint security, involved third-party monitoring and verification regimes of the kind that you have in arms control talks. Those kind of things have to be integrated here because there's no trust between the parties, nor do the parties warrant the trust of each other, because we have a history of six Israeli-Palestinian agreements being signed and breached by both sides.
Right, right. So, and really the existential issues between the two groups are recognition of Israel and the Israeli state for the Palestinians and giving up security control in the West Bank by the Israelis, which is what the Palestinians expect.
I think that the only existential question facing Israel today is whether or not it can continue to call itself the democratic nation state of the Jewish people and rule over millions of Palestinians who aren't Jewish, don't want to be Jewish, and Israel doesn't want to give them democratic rights. We are now 50 years into a binational one-state reality since June 1967. We're 70 years since the decision of the United Nations to partition Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. And we're 100 years after the Balfour Declaration, which gave the Jews the right to build a homeland in Palestine. These dates are very symbolic in terms of us focusing on the reality on the ground. And this Israel, as it defines itself, the democratic nation state of the Jewish people, is something which cannot go on for much longer. There needs to be a change. And this is the existential question for Israel. This whole issue of Palestinians recognizing Israel as a Jewish state is not important.
Really?
They recognize the state of Israel. They're willing to make peace with the state of Israel. Their compromise was also that they were demanding 22% of the land of Palestine, the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and accepting Israel in its pre-1967 borders, which is 78% of the land. This recognizing of Israel as a Jewish state is something which should have never been put on the table. It's a question that Israel has to address for itself, what the Jewishness of the state means. It's an internal argument amongst Jews. No other country of the world recognizes Israel as the Jewish state. And making the demand of the Palestinians was essentially, I think, a trap. The Palestinians fell in the trap because the Palestinian president and the Palestinian chief negotiator immediately said, we will never recognize Israel as the Jewish state, which basically gave a message to the Jewish people living in the state of Israel that the Palestinians will never make peace with them. But that wasn't what they were saying. They were saying that the question of the Jewishness of Israel is not for us to decide. Number two, there are 1.5 million Palestinian Arabs who are citizens of the state of Israel. What's their status if we recognize Israel as a Jewish state? And what happens to our own personal narrative? From our point of view, all the land between the river and the sea, you might call the land of Israel, but we call it the land of Palestine. It's our land, too. We're willing to make compromises on it. They've also said something which is, I think, quite intelligent. They said, if you want us to recognize Israel as the Jewish state, then call yourselves the Jewish state. We recognize the state of Israel. Yasser Arafat in September 1993 gave Yitzhak Rabin a letter in which it said, we, the PLO, the legitimate representatives of the Palestinian people, recognize the state of Israel as a right to exist and have defensible borders. What more do you need in making a peace process? The state of Israel, by the way, has not yet recognized a Palestinian state or even the right of the Palestinians for self-determination of a state of their own. If we're talking about reciprocity and mutuality in mutual recognition, there should be a government of Israel statement that Israel recognizes the Palestinian people's right to a state.
Now, Hamas, is Hamas a different story than the Palestinian Authority?
Hamas is a different story, but even here we have changes going on. Hamas is an Islamic movement, an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's a Palestinian national Islamic movement. It's not part of the wider federation or confederation or world movement of Muslim Brotherhood organizations. They don't recognize Israel's right to exist. They claim that all of Palestine from the river to the sea is Palestinian and Israel needs to disappear. And they're willing to use mukawama, as it's called in Arabic, resistance, which we in Israel call terrorism, in order to gain their rights with violence. The armed struggle is still a valid use as opposed to President Abbas, who is opposed to an armed struggle. But here also we have changes that are going on in the region with regard to Hamas, and it's been reported over the last weeks that Hamas is about to issue a new covenant in which they will say that they're not calling for the destruction of Israel, that they're willing to accept a Palestinian state in the 1967 borders. They are dissociating themselves from the Muslim Brotherhood entirely, and whether or not they will continue to support an armed struggle is still not yet determined because we haven't seen this new document. This is a direct result of the importance of Egypt in the relationship with Gaza, because the Egyptians had hardcore intelligence information that Hamas was cooperating with ISIS in Sinai, fighting against the Egyptian regime and the Egyptian army. And Egyptian army officers were being killed by ISIS, are still being killed by ISIS. And Hamas showed up in Cairo with a military delegation and said, we are not supporting ISIS, and it's not true. When the Egyptians pulled out photographs and hardcore intelligence information and said, stop lying to us. We have evidence that you are. And the Egyptians made conditions on Hamas. One of them was that there were about 42 ISIS people in Gaza that they demanded from Hamas to round up and turn over to the Egyptians, and they're doing that. They also demanded from Hamas to figure out a way to get Abbas's, the Palestinian Authority's presidential guards back to the border with Sinai as a condition that the Egyptians made for opening up the border between Gaza and Sinai and Egypt. This is a lifeline for the Gaza Strip.
There's no other way, yeah.
And the Egyptians have shown goodwill as Hamas has been cooperating and talking about issuing a new covenant by opening the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Sinai more frequently. In all of last year, it was open for about 25 days. Now it's been open for 3 or 4 days at a time, basically every week over the last 4 or 5 weeks.
This is a good sign. You said it really requires the two sides to get together, mm-hmm. but can Egypt be an honest broker?
Egypt is interested in Egyptian interest, and Egypt won't take on the burden of negotiating on behalf of the Palestinians for fear of being accused by the Arab world of making concessions to Israel. There is an Arab peace initiative that was issued in March of 2002 and ratified by the Arab League 5 or 6 times since, which basically sets parameters for an Israeli-Palestinian agreement, in which case, if it were to be done, the entire Arab world would recognize Israel and enter into normal diplomatic relations with Israel. It's also supported by 56 countries of the Conference of Islamic States. So this has been on the table for a long time, and the Egyptians have been saying to the Israelis, look at it, evaluate it again, support it. There was something that President Sisi was cooking with Netanyahu, but Netanyahu reneged on it, and in the last moment, instead of bringing in the Labor Party into his coalition, expanding it to have a more peaceful opportunity of negotiating, brought in Avigdor Lieberman and his right-wing Yisrael Beitenu party and destroyed the Sisi initiative. I think Sisi got burned, and he's not going to step up to the plate and put another initiative on the table right now.
Let me ask you about that Hamas document. We're still understanding exactly what's in it.
Yeah.
Does that become an opening for, instead of secret back-channel discussions between Hamas and Israel, maybe an open discussion?
I don't think it's an opening for a direct Israeli-Hamas contact, but we will see some players in the international community who adhered to what they call the quartet conditions. 3 conditions were put on Hamas in order for the international community to engage with them. One was accepting the Oslo framework of negotiations, of renouncing violence, and recognizing Israel. Hamas rejected all three of those. That has been a condition that even President Abbas has said would be relevant on Hamas. I think the door opens up for a real reconciliation process within the Palestinian political house that could enable new Palestinian elections, which are very important because President Abbas, although he supports peace and is against violence, he's in the 12th year of a four-year term.
Right.
So they really do need to go back to a democratic process and have elections. And Hamas's being outside of the realm of what the international community could deal with has not been able to facilitate a possible real Palestinian reconciliation.
So the reconciliation may be the first
I think that would be
between
the
Palestinian
step.
Authority and Hamas.
And then we would see individual countries in Europe breaking the EU ban on dealing with Hamas as well. Countries like Sweden, countries not in the EU who have engaged Hamas in the past but haven't in the last couple of years, like Norway, Switzerland, as being the first to step in. Maybe some of the other EU countries would come, and certainly Russia would be freer also to engage Hamas directly. Turkey is already engaging, and there could be some broader regional consequences of Hamas having a new document of this kind. And what's interesting to note is that the Hamas leadership in Gaza has been taken over by the most extreme elements within the Hamas's military wing. They're the ones who were just elected in their secret internal elections. The leader is now a man named Yahya Sinwar, who was released in the Shalit prisoner exchange in 2011 and is known to be one of the most extreme pro-Iranian players in the Gaza Strip. But the pressure and the power of Egypt with regard to the future relations with Gaza are so important that even someone like Yahya Sinwar has to give in to the possibility of political changes within Hamas.
What's the chance that this is a ploy, basically, to lessen the pressure on all the pressure that's brought to bear on Gaza?
Hamas doesn't play games. They don't. They are very upfront about what they believe and what they say. They have a very complex, secretive means of making decisions, and it's made by consensus, and they have elections that take place inside Israeli prisons, in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in the Palestinian diaspora, and these different secret bodies. No one knows who the decision makers are, but it's a process that takes months for them to make decisions. And once a decision is made, it's public, and everyone knows. If they're going to issue a new covenant, it's going to be very public. It's going to be out there for everyone to see.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
It seems like it's interesting times for your organization then.
It's interesting times, but it's very difficult times for anyone in Israel or Palestine who supports peace and negotiations, because we have a whole generation of Israelis and Palestinians who haven't spoken with each other. The trend and the belief is that we have no partner on the other side. There's a populist anti-normalization campaign in Palestine that tells people you shouldn't even talk to Israelis, and people who do get ostracized, punished, and sometimes attacked. On the Israeli side, you're often painted now as it's very much like an American now. If you have politics that don't support the administration, you're ostracized. You're treated as a traitor. You're labeled as very bad names. In Israel, to be called a leftist today is a curse. It's like no one wants to be called a leftist anymore.
So you know, the old conventional wisdom was that the majority of people in both states wanted a peace process.
It's still that way.
It's still that way.
But a bigger majority don't believe it's possible.
Hmm. Gershon Baskin, thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gershon Baskin is the co-chairman of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, which has recently been renamed the Israel-Palestine Creative Regional Initiatives. He was a guest of the Tulsa Committee on Foreign Relations last night. His new book, In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine, will be coming out this year from Vanderbilt University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.